I will just give some brief introductions and also some initial thoughts, and then we just move on to the program itself. So I'll be joined today by Professor Mario Campone, Chief Executive Officer of the Institut de Cancerologie de l'Ouest in France, and also Professor Beppe Viale, Chairman of the Department of Pathology, University of Milan in Italy. I'll start also with one of my patients. So she is a female with 67 years old, nothing particularly important in her past medical history except perhaps asthma. She has a strong family history. Her daughter died with breast cancer, diagnosed in the 30s and died in her 40s. She also has prostate cancer in one of her brothers, and mother with breast cancer at the age of 65. So in September 2019, she felt a lump in her left breast, but neglected it to take care of her brother, that in the meantime had also cancer. And only in May 2020 sought for medical attention. And at that time, imaging revealed a node with almost 5 centimeters for 47 millimeters, an additional node, 2 suspicious axillary lymph nodes. A biopsy revealed invasive carcinoma, non-special type, grade 2, ER100, PR40, HER2 negative with 0, Ki67 50%, and confirmed positive for lymph node metastasis. In their staging, we did a PET CT. We can discuss later on if this was appropriate. And what we saw was that it was a metastatic disease at diagnosis with several lymph nodes involvement, but also multiple and bilateral lung nodules and a suspicious bone lesion in the 5th lumbar vertebra. Everything else was normal in the blood workup, including normal tumor markers. So, for this specific case, postmenopausal lady with de novo metastatic disease, which would be your preferred approach outside the clinical trial? What would be the options and the preferred options? Of course, endocrine-based therapy would be the preferred option here and in almost all cases of ER-positive, HER2-negative. And the exception is being restricted more and more to just the presence of what we call visceral crisis. And we have a more precise definition of visceral crisis to help you understand exactly what we mean when we say visceral crisis. So it doesn't mean several metastases in a particular organ, but it means that the function of that organ is alterated. So for example, in this case, she has several lung metastases. However, there is no dyspnea. And for, we consider visceral crisis, we would have to have increasing dyspnea at rest without a pleural effusion. Very often people ask if pleural effusion is a visceral crisis. It is not. So you drain the pleural effusion, and if the dyspnea is over after that, there is no longer a visceral crisis. There are situations where even after draining the pleural effusion, the patient still remains with dyspnea, and in that case, you may consider it a visceral crisis. For the liver, for example, you need a rapidly increasing bilirubin and not just several liver metastases. So from all the trials that we already had, I think we are all in agreement that the standard of care for first-line therapy is endocrine therapy and the CDK4/6 inhibitor. The limiting cost in several areas of the world is cost. But if we put that aside for a while, this is indeed our strongest data is for endocrine therapy and the CDK4/6 inhibitor. And we can combine any of the CDK4/6 inhibitors with an aromatase inhibitor or with fulvestrant. There is some interaction with tamoxifen and some of the CDK4/6 inhibitors, particularly ribociclib, and that's why it is not there in the guideline. We can use in de novo and recurrent metastatic disease. We can use it in first and second line. We will discuss a little bit which one is the preferred, to go first line or to reserve for second line. And we can also go for primary or secondary resistant. And this is the same for a postmenopausal woman, for a premenopausal woman, for as long as you give a ovarian function suppression or ablation, and also to male patient with metastatic disease, also preferably with an LHRH agonist. So for first line setting, we have a consistent 30% risk reduction of death. So remember the first question. And then an overall survival benefit in absolute terms that it is more than a year. We have seen that in Mona Lisa 7, in Mona Lisa 3, 4, the subset of the first line setting. And also if we look at the Mona Lisa 3 overall population, we have an absolute benefit of more than 1 year. Now, for the first time, we have seen a medium survival over 5 years. And so this is, of course, extraordinary for this subtype, similar to what we see in HER2-positive in the CLEOPATRA trial. So also over 50 months, so 60 months, medium overall survival. And I would remind you that we do not have any chemotherapy agent that provides such benefit in the first-line setting. Now, there are two types of populations, what we sometimes call endocrine resistance and endocrine sensitive, and the CDK4/6 inhibitors work in both. But you look at the shape of the curves, they are different. So when you have an endocrine resistant disease, the curves separate immediately, right? So you see immediately the benefit of adding a CDK4/6 inhibitor. When you are in the presence of an endocrine sensitive population, it takes about 2 years before the curves separate. So this raises the hypothesis that probably the CDK4/6 is really active when there is already resistance or to delay the appearance of that resistance. Now, for a long time, people have been not including premenopausal patients in trials of new drugs. Fortunately, the CDK4/6 inhibitors, that did not happen. They even had a separate trial. Not that I think it is necessary to have separate trials, but we should not exclude premenopausal women. And you can see here in the Mona Lisa 7, the magnitude of the benefit is the same for premenopausal as it was for postmenopausal. There was also a fear of a fast progression after the use of a CDK4/6 inhibitor. This, in the beginning of the use of these drugs, there were descriptions of cases of patients with a very fast progressive disease after a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So this is not proven. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen to one or two patients, but you can see here what we call PFS2. Which is the PFS under the second treatment, the treatment after a CDK4/6. And you can see that those who remain to have a better benefit are those who receive the CDK4/6 inhibitor. So we can also use them in the second line setting, and the relative risk reduction is about the same, 30%. But the absolute benefit, as always, is smaller in a second line setting. So between 6 to 9 months benefit in overall survival, as opposed to 1 year or more in the first line setting. But again, in the second line setting, we do not have chemotherapy that provides such a benefit. So one last point about the importance of long-term follow-up when we are discussing treatments for this subtype. So Paloma 3 initially didn't have a significant overall survival benefit. Only after a medium follow-up of 73 months, then we were able to see a statistically significant benefit in overall survival. So that calls the attention that we have to continue to follow these patients for a long time. And we can use also chemotherapy before doing that, but there is really no benefit in doing so. And of course, for those who are more heavily pretreated, the benefit is smaller when you give these agents. Finally, in terms of quality of life, what we see in all the trials is that there is no degradation of quality of life. Sometimes there is stable quality of life, and in Mona Lisa 7 there is an improvement in quality of life. This is both in the metastatic and for the first line and the second line. So summarizing, for the first line setting, very few patients would need chemotherapy. About 10 to 15% would have visceral crisis. Perhaps there is a group of patients who could be treated with endocrine therapy alone that I call there with low burden, less aggressive biology. But for the majority of them, CDK4/6 and endocrine therapy is the choice. Now, if you live in a country that you don't have access for CDK4/6, I think it is extremely important to know that the second best choice is endocrine therapy, is not chemotherapy. Now, let's go back to my patient. So what did we do? We treated it with letrozole, ribociclib, and a bone-modifying agent, a very good partial response in all the metastases. Now, moving on, so what have we done in the meantime? We did genetic testing. There was no BRCA mutation. We also looked for PIK3CA mutation in the tumor that was negative. And after 12 months, there was progressive disease. When we are going to a second line, we don't have to go for chemotherapy. On the contrary, what is recommended is to continue to several lines of endocrine therapy. What are those lines? Very briefly, so we have the possibility of giving endocrine therapy with everolimus, particularly if we take the prophylactic steroid mouthwash, is a very good treatment. It is also costly. And just reminding, something else that you can do besides the mouthwash, it's to start at a lower dose and just increase if there is very good tolerance. This is an example of a GBG trial starting with lower dose and then increasing the dose of everolimus, allowing for a much better control of the mucositis. Alpelisib is a treatment combined with endocrine therapy for the situation of PIK3CA mutation tumors. Again, the limiting factor being cost, but here there's also a second limiting factor, which is toxicity. This is indeed a toxic agent. We have not seen a statistically significant overall survival benefit, but we do see PFS benefit. And one thing that you can have a look when you want to see if a drug is well tolerated or not is to see the percentage of dose reductions and dose interruptions. And you can see here it mounts to 70% of patients. Again, there are a lot of things that you can do to control the side effects. Antihistaminic. Also, I use prophylactic mouthwashes and control of hyperglycemia and hyperlipidemia. So the main take-home message is to use several lines of endocrine therapy before you go for chemotherapy and give the same options to premenopausal women with ovarian function suppression or ablation and to men with an LHRH agonist.
Thank you so much, Fatima. The question is now, if in addition to the usual biomarkers, ER, PR, HER2, and Ki67, if there are some biomarkers that may allow this lady to be eligible for clinical trials in this metastatic setting. So we will go through these additional biomarkers, and I put here also the score for these biomarkers according to the HISCAT. With the exception of HER2 low, I didn't put the current score for HER2 low because, as you know, at ASCO, we will have the final results of the DESTINY-Breast04 trial, which likely will change the judgment and the score for HER2 low. So let's start with the ESR1 mutations. We know ESR1 mutations since a long time, from 97, but the role of these mutations in the endocrine therapy resistance was only established a few years ago. We know that the prevalence of ESR1 mutations in breast cancer patients depends on two factors: the prior duration and the setting of the endocrine therapy. So we know that at the beginning, in early breast cancer, endocrine therapy naive, ESR mutations are very uncommon, maybe less than 1% of the cases. It increases after neoadjuvant AI treatment, and in recurrent breast cancer, again after a prior adjuvant aromatase inhibitor treatment. But the most common situation is for ESR1 mutations to appear or to be enriched in metastatic breast cancers if the patient has been treated with AIs. So we have to conclude that these mutations in a hormone receptor positive breast cancer occur mostly after AI in the metastatic setting. What is the role of these mutations for the resistance to endocrine therapy? Well, almost all, possibly all, the mutations in the ESR1 are in the ligand binding portion of the molecule. And there are some of these mutations that are most common. We normally test these mutations either in the tissue biopsy or on circulating tumor cells or in the cell-free DNA, the circulating DNA. And we are using different detection assays, and the most sensitive among them is the droplet digital PCR. It has been also tested, the evaluation of these ESR1 mutations during the serial progression of the disease, in order to see whether we will be able to predict the recurrence or the evolution of the tumor just based on the evaluation of these mutations in the blood well before the new progression will appear clinically. We have to remember also that these mutations are only responsible for approximately 50% of the cases of resistance to endocrine treatment. There are several other mechanisms of resistance, and some of them, again, they will be in the ESR1 gene, because we will be able to detect in some cases the loss of the gene, the amplification of the ESR1, and sometimes we have translocations of these genes. According to the recommendation of the panelists of the Advanced Breast Cancer 6 meeting, whenever we encounter a mutation in this gene, we have to choose a treatment that will exclude aromatase inhibitors. And in case of disease progression, under treatment with one of these aromatase inhibitors, the acquired ESR1 mutations are common, as we have seen, and so the next line of therapy should exclude the aromatase inhibitor treatment. So once we have tested for ESR1, what are the options for clinical trials? Well, we have a number of clinical trials for patients with ESR1 mutation, either a trial that are just focusing on these patients or trials where the ESR1 mutation are used as a stratification factor. These trials will include estrogen receptor modulators or covalent antagonists, the CERCAs, or new selective estrogen receptor degraders, the SERDs, either in monotherapy or in combination with other agents. And then we have more unusual drugs like the proteolysis targeting chimera or the combination of tamoxifen and some immune checkpoint inhibitors, particularly with pembrolizumab. So there is plenty of opportunities for clinical trials in this setting. The second biomarker actually is an entire pathway, because we know that PI3 kinase AKT/mTOR pathway is very important in this setting. And this pathway is activated in almost, or maybe more than, 70% of breast cancer patients. Certainly the most common alteration is a mutation in the PIK3CA gene that is responsible for mutations occurring in almost 25 or 40% of breast cancer patients. Then we have additional mechanisms of activation of this pathway. We may have the amplification of the PIK3CA gene in some 8% of breast cancer patients. We have the loss of heterozygosity in the P10 in one quarter of breast cancer patients. And then we have aberrations for the AKT1 or AKT2 gene. So again, this pathway may be aberrant under a number of different situations. And we have been asked to look specifically for the most common of these aberrations, which is the PIK3CA mutation. And certainly, we know that the alpelisib has been mentioned. Whenever it is available, after testing for PIK3CA mutation, where should we test? Well, we may test the mutation both in the tissue and in the blood. Certainly, the sensitivity until now, the sensitivity of the mutation detection in the blood is inferior as compared to the tissue. So whenever you have a negative test on the circulating DNA, then it is important for you to go back and to try to retrieve the original block of the breast cancer, the primary breast cancer, or to get a biopsy of the metastatic site in order to have tissue available for the search in the mutation. Again, in case of a mutation or aberration in this pathway, there are a number of clinical trials for whom the patient could be eligible. Some of them, again, are based on the treatment with alpelisib because, you know, in Europe, the approval of alpelisib will exclude patients that have been treated with a combination of endocrine treatment plus CDK4/6 inhibitor. So there is a trial currently ongoing that is testing the opportunity of using alpelisib after the treatment with endocrine and CDK4/6 inhibitors. And then we have trials that are using AKT inhibitors, and there is quite a number of these agents that may inhibit AKT, which include a number of new drugs and some drugs that are competitive against the ATP. And finally, we are now seeing whether this new expression of HER2 in breast cancer is a low expression of HER2, which is defined as an immunohistochemical score of 1+ or 2+ without gene amplification, may be relevant in this setting. We know that more than 50% of the population of breast cancer patients have a tumor that has a low expression of HER2, according to the definition. This is more common in hormone receptor positive breast cancer as compared to triple negative breast cancer. Only about approximately 1/3 of triple negative breast cancer have this low expression of HER2, whereas more than 55% of hormone receptor positive breast cancer carry this low expression. And also, there is the tendency also to start considering those tumors that have that achieve an immunohistochemical score of 0, so no evidence, but actually they have a very minor fraction of tumor cells that express some immunoreactivity for HER2. These tumors have been variably called as ultra-low expressor, or tumors with a score which is more than 0 but less than 1. So these patients with these kind of tumors may be eligible for, again, a number of ongoing phase 3 trial. The Destiny Breast 04, as I told you, is completed, and it will be reported. It has been reported already in a press release, but it will be officially reported at ASCO. But there are additional trials that are ongoing for patients whose tumors will express, have a low expression, or even an ultra-low expression of HER2. So at the end, this patient is eligible for a number of clinical trials, and according to the detection of the different biomarkers, we may certainly address this patient for a specific clinical trial. Thank you, Fatima.
Thank you. Beppe, maybe just take the opportunity. There was a question I think you already asked, you answered, about looking for PIK3CA in the blood or the tumor. But also, what about looking for the primary or a metastatic site?
Well, whenever the primary is available, we do not need to have a biopsy of the metastatic site. Certainly when the primary tumor is not available because the patient has been treated elsewhere, so it is important to have a biopsy of the metastatic site in case of a negative test in the blood, because the sensitivity of the test is lower in the blood. Till now, you never know in the future.
I see this patient 2 weeks ago. He's a 70-year-old postmenopausal patient. He's a T2N0, M0, of the breast conservative surgery, and the final report of pathology side is a size of 45 millimeters, grade 3, ER and PR positive. HER2 1 plus and K67 is a 70%. There are 4 positive node involvement. This patient received adjuvant sitting, chemotherapy, anthracycline followed by taxane, radiotherapy, and this we discussed about the adjuvant and treatment and the addition of CDK inhibitor. There is different definition of high risk population. There is first the clinical characteristics of high risk, the indication of K67 and genomic molecular assay to assess the risk of recurrence. First, we start with the clinical characteristic. About this slide, you have 2 key messages. First message, it's a clear correlation between the stage and the risk of recurrence. And the second message is independently of the stage, the majority of relapse occur during the 2 first year. It's very important for to explain the activity of abemaciclib, for example, in adjuvant setting. Is a clear correlation with the size of tumor, is a clear correlation with the node involvement, and clear correlation with the stage. The other point is the importance of Ki-77. In this graph, you have the result if in Monarch E, you have population who are not treated by abemaciclib, but you have 2 populations, where population were high level of Ki-77 and low Ki-87, and there is a clear correlation with the high level with a more relapse for this patient. There is other prognostic factor produced by the SOFTEX trial. There is the age, but most important, you have the Ki-77, the grade of tumor, the level of expression of receptor progesterone, the level of expression of ER, and the tumor size, and the number of node involvement. Other definition for high-risk population would be the recurrence score in the SWOG clinical trial in ER node-positive patient. When you have a recurrence score very high, you have a risk of relapse when you receive only tamoxifen. In panel B, when you stratify by the molecular subtype in this population, you have clear correlation between different subtypes and the risk of relapse. The luminal B and normal B, it's a good prognostic, but you are luminal B, basal-like, and HER2 is a poor prognostic, and we are more relapse in this subclass, molecular subclass. Endocrine therapy resistance is a key feature of the high risk ER HER2 negative advanced breast cancer. They recur within 5 years of diagnostic. The tumor size, the nodal status, and the grad impact recurrence risk. It improves prognostic accuracy of gene expression in HER2. The EGFR proliferation and the lower ER level increase risk of recurrence. The luminal B, HER2 unrich, and basal-like at high risk for relapse. And the most important is to have new therapy to improve the endocrine therapy for the first 2 years, because the majority of patients relapse during these 2 years when you have a high risk. You have different clinical trials to support this. You have the Penelope B with the palbociclib, Palas B with the palbociclib, Monarch E with abemaciclib, and Nathalie with ribociclib, but this clinical trial is ongoing. First is the Palas. We randomize palbociclib 2 years plus endocrine therapy to endocrine therapy for patients who are stage 2 and 3. When you see the whole population, there is high-risk population, but you have intermediate-risk population were included in this clinical trial. It probably explain why there is no difference between the two arms to palbociclib plus endocrine treatment comparing to endocrine treatment in this population. In Penelope B is after a neoadjuvant treatment where patients are defined with a high risk. The high risk with the CPS EG score more than 3 and node involvement more than 2. The patient receive after radiotherapy palbociclib for 1 year plus endocrine treatment comparing to endocrine treatment plus placebo. In this case, there is no difference in terms of ADFS between the two arms. And when you see the stratification of the patient, there is no advantages to give palbociclib when you have a Ki-67 very high, when you have a residual status or enough involvement. The last clinical trial is the Monarch E. In Monarch E, you have 2 cohorts. First cohort is based by the definition of high risk. The high risk is to have more 4 node involvement. If you have 1 or 3 node involvement, you have necessary to have 2 other criteria, a grade 3 of the tumor size more than 5 centimeters. The second cohort is biased by the level of Ki-67. If you have a Ki-67 very high, the 20%, you are necessary to have 1 or 3 node involvement or no grade 3 and no tumor more than 5 centimeters. This study randomized during 2 years abemaciclib to endocrine therapy, to endocrine therapy. You can see there is a clear advantage to combine abemaciclib to endocrine treatment during the 2 first years with a risk of reduction of relapse. But the most important, when you stop abemaciclib, you maintain the benefits after. You have a carryover effect at the end of the treatment of abemaciclib. You reduce the risk for 30%. Developing an EDFS, and the absolute difference is a 5.4 at the 3 years. It's the same when you see the different period of follow-up at between 0.1, 1.2, and more than 2 years. You have a conservative EDFS and DRFS in this population. What happened when you, the cohort 2, with the high level of Ki-77, same result. You have a clear benefit to combine abemaciclib to endocrine treatment, compared to endocrine treatment only. And same effect, when you stop abemaciclib, you continue to maintain the benefit after. For the Ki-77 is a prognostic factor. But when you use abemaciclib, you have the same benefits in the 2 cohorts with the low or high level of Ki-67. Comparing the different populations in the Penelope, Palas, and Monarch E, I think the most difference is the selection of patients. In Monarch E, it's a very definition of high-risk patients. Comparing to Palas, you have a mix of moderate and high risk. And probably in the, you are more high risk in Penelope, but I'm not sure it's a good definition for high risk population in this case. In conclusion, about 20% of ER positive, HER2 negative early breast cancer are primary endocrine therapy resistant and have a high risk to early recurrence. 2 years of adjuvant abemaciclib significantly improved DFS and distant DFS in patients with node positive, high risk, with a high level of 67, more than 20%. It's a new standard of care option, but follow-up is ongoing to have more information after. Thank you very much.
So there were a couple of interesting questions submitted. One of them has to do with the possibility to use a CDK4/6 inhibitor even in the presence of cardiotoxicity. So is that a contraindication? Do you want to address that, Mario?
It's not a contraindication of use a CDK inhibitor except for ribociclib when you have the prolongated QTC. But except this case, you can use all CDK inhibitor in metastatic setting because you are not dysfunction of myocardial.
Exactly. The question was exactly on low ejection fraction, so yeah, there is no contraindication, unlike anti-HER2 therapy, where there is the effect in the fraction or the muscular activity of the heart. Another question, which it's interesting and difficult. So let's say we have someone who develops a local recurrence, okay, and you treat with local therapy, let's say surgery, no radiation if there was given radiation initially, and it's ER positive, HER2 negative. So what do you do? Do you treat as a metastatic disease and you start endocrine therapy and the CDK4/6 until progression, or do you treat as early breast cancer and you treat with endocrine therapy and abemaciclib for 2 years, or you treat with endocrine therapy alone? I think it is a very good question.
Yes, and very good, yeah.
Possibly a question without answer, but
I think it depends on the time of relapse, of local relapse. It's a very early relapse after the 2 years on the hand. Probably I use abemaciclib and endocrine treatment as a definition of a very high-risk population for 2 years. I'm not sure if the relapse is more than 5 years, 10 years, you can use CDK inhibitor in this case, because probably it's a very sensitive to endocrine treatment. It's probably the failure of the surgery in radiotherapy, not the adjuvant treatment.
Surgeons never fail.
No, so.
Okay, so I tend to agree with you. So if you have a very localized local recurrence, even local regional, but a localized, not very extensive, and it has been 5, 6, 7 years since you stopped adjuvant endocrine therapy, I would treat with another endocrine therapy alone. If that local relapse occurs during adjuvant endocrine therapy, that is more difficult, and possibly we would like to give something else besides just changing the endocrine therapy. And I remind you that abemaciclib is not approved for that. So I don't know if you would have access to that or if you have to lie to your regulators and say that you are in a metastatic situation. I don't think that we could go with any of the approvals, right? But it is a situation where it would be okay to use abemaciclib. Let's do the parallel with HER2-positive disease. If you have a local regional recurrence in HER2-positive, you go back to do 1 year of trastuzumab. You don't do trastuzumab until progression. So I think here we could do this parallel, even though it is a data-free zone. Now, if I cannot find a situation where I would give endocrine therapy and the CDK4/6 until progression. I don't think so. I would do it in a limited number of years, depending disease-free interval and if it's during or after adjuvant endocrine therapy. I don't know, Beppe.
It's okay with me.
So the other interesting question here is about the management of neutropenia. So let's say that someone has a persistent neutropenia with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Which one would be best, to increase the interval instead of 1 week, 2 weeks, or to decrease the dose? Do you want to tackle that?
I think the two options is valid. You can start to prolong the interval if you have, for example, two times you have to prolong, you have to reduce for the third world. But I prefer at the beginning to prolong the interval and after to reduce.
So actually I have
It's a very empiric. Yeah?
I have another opinion. I think it is, I prefer to reduce the dose because I think for the majority of drugs that we use in the metastatic setting, we use too high doses. The doses are much higher than we actually need. They are done this way because we always develop the maximum tolerated dose. And for these targeted agents, this is something we've been discussing at ABC, we really don't need to go up to the maximum tolerated dose. We should aim to define the minimum dose that does the job and not the maximum. So, and we also have, I know it's limited data and subgroup analyses of all the trials that look at patients who had a dose reduction, and there seems not to be a major problem with efficacy if you reduce the dose. And there is still an open question. Is it better to give continuously or to have intervals? You know, there's one of the discussions about Pallas and Monarch E is about the continuous of abemaciclib or the interval that you give with palbo and ribo. That's why Natalie will be so important. For example, for everolimus, we have data from the preclinical studies that it's much better to continue to block the pathway than to do it intermittently. And so for everolimus, I also prefer to lower the dose than have to do intervals in administration. And you can lower the dose without any problem. By the way, just a question that came up, if I will let Beppe tackle that one. It says, if you have no mutation in PIK3CA, can you use everolimus? Of course.
Oh, certainly yes, because you do not know what is in the pathway. I've shown that the pathway is very complicated. There are so many members. So the fact that you don't find PIK3CA mutation does not tell you that the pathway is not activated.
Exactly. Now, another difficult question, so I'll go for Mario. It says, let's say that one of the patients of Monarch E, unfortunately, has a relapse.
Uh-huh.
So what would be your first line or first option for the first line treatment?
I think it's a good question because you have no data about CDK inhibitor after CDK inhibitor. Nobody knows. If patient relapse, probably is a very resistant to endocrine treatment. It probably is a good candidate for chemotherapy. And perhaps if the Destiny 06 is positive and the patient have too low, probably when the good option is to use trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Again, nobody still knows, but I would tend to do, again, a parallel to the HER2-positive situation. So when we started use trastuzumab in the early setting, we would still give it in the metastatic setting, right? And it is true that then we saw that giving it together with pertuzumab was better. So what we need for sure in the coming years, and this is something we've been asking also, is for studies that look at the use of a different CDK4/6 inhibitor after you have used one, either in the adjuvant setting or even in further lines. Let's say that you use in the first line and you would like to know if it would be better, instead of endocrine therapy alone, to go again with the CDK4/6 inhibitor. I've been asking for these trials, but they haven't done it yet.
It's not the same story, because HER2 is addict. It is oncogenic addictive pathway, all right? Mm. And to maintain the pressure in this pathway, okay, it's correct. You have the clinical trial who prove to maintain this pressure during this pathway. I'm not sure it's the same for CDK inhibitor, for example. But now you have different CDK inhibitor. We not only for 4 and 6 inhib, but you have the possibility to inhib 9, CDK9, is one of mechanism implicating in the resistance of the CDK4/6. Probably the new CDK inhibitor with a pan CDK inhibitor, not the first generation of flavoperidol, for example, which is very toxic, but the new generation probably respond to this question.
Yeah, and then you have to go and look for other mechanisms or resistance. Cyclin E, for instance, you have to look for that.
I think that there it would be very important to analyze the mechanisms of resistance of a CDK and then help us decide what to do after the relapse of a CDK. But I still think we need to evaluate the cross-resistance between the three CDK4/6 inhibitors. I remember many, many years ago, we did the same with the three aromatase inhibitors. And we still use a non-steroider after steroider and vice versa. So I think it would be important to have those data. But unfortunately, we don't have the data yet. And I think, yes, if it would be a HER2-low disease, certainly that will be soon another option to consider. Now, let's see if we have answered all the questions. Oh, this one is very difficult. I don't think you can do this. People are having difficulty swallowing an oral CDK4/6, any suggestion like disperse it in water? I don't think we can do that. It's not the biggest pill. Try to swallow capecitabine. That is a big pill. I don't think we can dissolve it in water, right? Not that I have. This is one of those things, don't do it at home. So don't tell your patient to disperse it in water. I don't think so.
If I remember, in Europe, the approval it is for the cohort 1, is for patients who have 1 or 2 node involvement and the other pejorative criteria. I think it's a good definition for high-risk population. You are not to base only of KI67.
Yeah, I agree. I would have problems on basing exclusively on KI67. I think more than 4 nodes and all the other clinical pathologic characteristics should be used together with the KI67.
Yeah, even because I think that the difference in terms of reproducibility between 19% KI67 and 21% KI67 is very difficult to assess. I mean, but I think that ASCO and CNN recommendations, they do not take into account KI67. In the US?
Well, but the problem is the approval, because they approved based on KI67, which is very funny for US, where they have never been such big fans
for sure,
of KI67.